Good morning.
Good morning.
Imagine that you're sitting in here rather than being outside on such a beautiful morning. But here you are. Here we are. So this is my second talk on Buddhism and its psychotherapy. And I'm going to give one of my next Sunday talk, which is probably in about 2 weeks, will be my third talk. So just to review a little bit, last time I talked about the cognitive... Hi, come on in and sit down. Last time I talked about the cognitive part of the Buddhist path, and I talked about cognitive therapy and the relation between those two. And today I'm going to talk about the behavioral part of the path and behavioral therapy and how those two complement each other. And then next time I'll talk about the meditative part of the path and psychodynamic therapy. So, last time I talked a little bit about how cognitive therapy works with specific cognitive distortions, like all or nothing thinking, to replace them with something more functional. And Buddhist practice really is about discovering a peace of mind, or peace of no mind, if you want to be Zen, where we see through and beyond the limitations of any cognitive hang-ups, any cognitive repetitive or obsessive or negative patterns of thinking. And right behavior or appropriate behavior or sound behavior in the Eightfold Path follows after right thought or right aspiration. So I got to talk a little bit about that, to talk about behavior. What's our aspiration? What's our aspiration in our lives right now? What do we want? What do we want from the world around us? What do we want for ourselves? What do we want for the world around us? Maybe we want a little more peace. Most of us do. Be a little loving. Be a little more loving to ourselves and to others. A little wiser. Take it all a little less seriously. Just a little less seriously. Don't beat yourself up. I'm not taking it too seriously. Just a little less seriously. We want that. We have an aspiration, most of us. Why we do Buddhist practice, or why we come to listen to Dharma talks. We want that. And if our life is out of harmony, we want to bring it back into harmony, because there is a basic harmony of our being with all being. That's the understanding that I talked about last time. We understand that first in our heads, but we want to get it into our hearts, into our very being. So we try to do behaviors that will bring us back into harmony when we're out of harmony. Back into quietness when we're all revved up. Back into open-hearted compassion when we're just feeling like we hate everyone, including ourselves. And as soon as we say that, we're doing all or nothing thinking. But that's last time. So it's difficult to see clearly. It's difficult to be wise, whatever that is. But maybe being wise is just being able to see clearly and behave in a way based on that clarity of seeing without the cognitive distortion. Maybe so. So then we don't need to suffer so much about our suffering. We can just suffer. We all suffer. You're not going to get away from it. If you want to get away from suffering, don't do Zen. Do something else. I don't know what you should do. Probably drugs and alcohol. for a while. You gotta increase it continually or something, right? I haven't done that for a while. But that was my practice 50 years ago. I was pretty practiced at it. So the behavioral part of the path, called Shila in Sanskrit, S-I-L-A. Conduct that's in accord with this feeling of interconnectedness, which we know about, which we get a little bit in our hearts, but we really want to get it in our hearts. We really want to manifest it. When we're with others, we want to. And right understanding and right thought point to that. So Jesus said, by their deeds ye shall know them. Huh. Right? Simple. So we're in our Buddhist practice, in our lives, we're trying to change our behavior in a gentle way, out of our aspiration, not out of some big should, but out of our aspiration. So we're sitting meditation, regular sitting practice, living a life which enables us to tap into stillness, even if we're not meditating formally. Can we adjust our lives to just tap into quietness? Try to be more considerate to others, including those people that we're closest to. Sometimes those are the people that we're not considerate of. I'm speaking from experience because we take them for granted or they get on our nerves or something. So trying to be considerate. Without suppressing or repressing our emotion, just trying to be considerate. So, I have called in the past the behavioral part of the path as being fake it until you make it. Oh. Some people like that. Some people thought it was stupid. I don't care. Anyway, in a way it is. Fake it until you make it. Nobody feels confident of doing these new behaviors 100% of the time. Nobody does. All of us feel awkward sometimes. And just we do it again. And we do it again. So I have talked several times about the Zen teacher whom I was the attendant to as a young man who had just come over from Japan, and he was, I think, in his early 30s, I don't know, probably in his early 30s. And he, and when my teacher Suzuki left the monastery, Chino Sensei then, was put in charge. And Suzuki had been giving a talk every night. So he said to Chino, you give a talk every night. And Chino really struggled with English. And so Chino, the first few times I heard him talk at night, he shook like a leaf. His voice shook. And we thought, that's a Zen teacher shaking like a leaf. Well, after a few years later, Wanda knows this story well. I don't know if I put it in my book. Chino, I met up with some of Chino's students, and they said, he's so relaxed when he gives his talks that sometimes he falls asleep. he just did it. He just made that commitment over and over. He just did it. So behavioral therapy in a formal sense, as it was developed in this country 60 years ago or so, is based on altering dysfunctional behavior. And that's an awkward process because we kind of like our dysfunctional behavior. At some level, we like it. It's a habit that, you know, keeps us going. So it's awkward. It's awkward. Also, behavioral therapy is about reinforcing desirable behaviors that are already present and eliminating unwanted or maladaptive ones. So, from a behavioral therapist's point of view, insights are irrelevant. It's behavior that counts. Emotions are fine, but it's behavior that counts. If you behave differently, your emotions and thought will follow. That's simple behavioral therapy principle. Action-based. So, old behaviors lead to the development of a problem, and new behaviors can fix it. So I'm going to talk about four behavioral therapy techniques in a fairly brief amount of time. And Jim, if you could get the clock out there, it will help me be brief. Thanks. Flooding. The first one is flooding. Exposing people to fear-invoking objects or situations. If you go on to someone who's well-versed in behavioral therapy, they might, and you have something that you're hung up on, they might work with you by helping you flood. The person is prevented from escaping or avoiding whatever it is. Let's say Matt's got an intense fear of dogs. Dogs are yipping at his heels at MIA. That's where he works. I don't think they let dogs into MIA.
Service
dogs. Oh, well, then the therapist would help Matt get exposed to small, friendly dogs for an extended period of time, during which Matt couldn't leave. He just has to stay there with a small, friendly dog. And after repeated exposures to the dog, during which nothing bad happens, the fear response begins to fade. The fear response begins to fade, and then actually drops away entirely. That's called flooding. So, a lot of you have done retreats here. You've done retreats, and I hope a lot more of you will be doing retreats, because it's a great opportunity to experience flooding. Great opportunity. So, here you are, sitting on your cushion. You signed up for a day. Ooh, 2 days. Ooh, a half day. Ooh. I mean, whatever it is, it's an ooh. Until you, for a while. So you're presented, you're exposed to fear-invoking situations. And if there's nothing fear-invoking about your retreat, then you must just be really drugged out. Talk about drugs and alcohol. Which in the old days people would. Well, I won't get into that, but so there you are. Sitting and this stuff is coming up and your leg is sore and you're just staying with it. You're just bringing yourself back after repeated exposure to the stuff that's coming up, to your worries and fears. The fear response begins to fade. It does. It begins to fade. And then, voila, it's gone until it comes back. It's gone. But once it's gone, then you really see that you have the possibility to not be burdened by this fear in your daily life. Not be burdened by it. It still comes, but you don't. It's not your heavy weight, not your heavy rock that you carry on your back. Second behavioral technique: systematic desensitization. Now, so how do you pronounce that? I don't know. You know what I mean. You're desensitizing yourself systematically with your therapist. Of course, you can be your own therapist. So think about behavior. All these therapies is that you can do this stuff yourself. But anyway, it's sometimes nice to have someone help you. So you've got this person helping you, and they're helping you desensitize. So they have you make a list of your fears. And then they teach you to relax while concentrating on these fears. First, they might teach you a relaxation technique like Zazen. Then they might have you create a ranked list of the fear-inducing situations, fear-invoking situations. Then, starting with the least fear-inducing item and working their way up to the most fear-inducing item, the biggest one, the client confronts these fears under the guidance of the therapist while maintaining a relaxed state. So let's take fear of the dark. Fear of the dark. You might start by looking at an image of a dark room. My two grandsons both have fear of the dark, so this would be good for them. I might start looking at an image of a dark room.
before moving on to thinking about being in a dark room, and then actually confronting his fear, your fear, by sitting in a dark room, by pairing the old fear-producing stimulus with a newly learned relaxation behavior, the fear response can be reduced or even eliminated. So, so many of us have little phobias or big phobias. Systematic desensitization, however you pronounce it, is good for that. Is good for that. So now Sunday tea. Look at all the people we have, and we have people coming downstairs. It's huge, and some people have told me this is too much for me. I get a little freaked out. I get a little scared. So okay, well now I'm your therapist. So I say, oh. Well, let's see if I can help you work on this. So how about coming, instead of on Sunday, coming on Tuesday? And how about just staying on Tuesday, because we all do the same talks on Tuesday, but with a much smaller group. How about just staying a little while on Tuesday, visiting with people for a little while, and definitely eating before the crowd comes down from upstairs. So that's number one. And then, okay, well, that felt pretty good. You know, I visited with a few people. I felt pretty good. I think I'm going to stick with that. And then the therapist says, no. No, the next thing, you're going to stay Tuesday a little longer. And then people are going to come downstairs. And you're going to be with the whole group. And you're just going to breathe. And you're just going to come back to being here. So, and if you have to leave, leave. Okay. Well, I did that. I don't have to come to Sunday. This is a wonderful group on Tuesday. Just right size. No, you got to come on Sunday. You're paying me big bucks. I'm charging you $150 an hour, right? Or something. I don't know what they charge now. I heard they charge that. It's been a long time since I was a therapist. So, come back on Sunday. And you can just stay a little while. Just stay a little while, talk to two people, and then go. Oh, I can't talk. Well, talk to one person. Just look at them, stand and breathe with them, and then go. Okay. Now stay a little longer, and then when you're really ready, stay till the people come downstairs. Then you have a huge group, and stay as long as you can, and then leave. Systematic desensitization, whatever it is. So that's the second. A third behavioral technique is just a very simple one, which we do all the time, and it's so much part of who we are that we don't realize that this was invented by behavioral therapists in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. Pernod Refn. Rewards for modifying behavior, right? Rewards for modifying behavior. My grandsons, who are 6 and 10, fight all the time except when they're playing. They play all the time except when they're fighting. I mean, they're like this, you know. And their playing always turns into fighting. But then they love each other. They really love each other. But they, you know, what do you... So my daughter's got the boys on a behavior modification program, right? And they got to pick their reward. You know, what do you want? Screen time, Mama. Screen time. The 6-year-old too. Screen time. I didn't even know what screen time was. On the iPhone, on the iPad, on the whatever. That's what 6-year-old kids want now is screen time. If you hang out with them. So okay. So my grandsons for 6 weeks, Aaron's been doing this. My grandsons get 10 minutes of screen time 3 times a day if they haven't laid into each other and gotten a big fight. She says it's working marvelously, especially for the 10-year-old. It makes the 6-year-old mad. But for the 10-year-old, well, 6-year-old, I don't know. But, you know, these things are not infallible, right? Not infallible. So for years, I had a big job out in the community, which taxed a lot of my energy. And then I had my Zen Center. I was doing this Zen Center. And I didn't have priests around to give other talks, so I just give all the talks. So often by Friday, I would be just, I don't know if I want to do this. I think I'm just going to veg out. But I decided Saturday would be my veg day. So for about 3 years, I had Saturday as my veg day. Totally, I can do whatever I want. Sit and eat peanut butter all day. People are different, but that's what was about. That would be my veg day. And I gave myself that reward. That was my own behavioral therapist. So in the last one that I want to refer to, talk a little bit about, is modeling. Modeling. So learning through observation and modeling the behavior of others. This is based on Albert Bandura's social learning theory, which emphasizes the social components of the learning process. We learn new skills or acceptable behaviors by watching someone else perform those skills. In some cases, the therapist might model the desired behavior. In other instances, watching peers engage in the sought-after behaviors can also be helpful. So Zen practice is a lot about modeling. I've talked about this before, about modeling and imprinting. In my own case, I had two Japanese teachers that I worked with for a long time, two Japanese Zen teachers who modeled for me some kind of ways of being in the world that got into me. It was just social learning theory. They got imprinted in me. They got into me. The two that I just thought of are, one, taking delight in small things. Both Suzuki and Katagiri modeled that for me. Suzuki used to show his hands the dirt in his fingernails and say, "Oh, isn't that wonderful?" So they modeled that, taking delight in small things. And they also modeled for me, which is not surprising, not getting wigged out by stuff. They modeled that. They didn't talk to me about that. And say, "Don't get wigged out, Tim." They just kind of showed me. Or just getting wigged out for short periods of time. I remember them both getting wigged out for short periods of time, but then it was gone. So modeling. So I learned about behavioral therapy more than 50 years ago when I was a student at Stanford in Palo Alto. I was actually a psych major, but I changed my major later because I didn't like behavioral therapy, for one thing. What I didn't like about behavioral therapy, which they were really emphasizing back then, was, they were emphasizing the work of a guy named B.F. Skinner, who was all into experimentation, and he used rats and mice, and he got them to change their behavior. And I was deeply offended, and I wanted to release the mice. So that was behavioral therapy in its infancy, but it became much more sophisticated and much more humane. The other thing I didn't like about it in my early years of Zen sitting was that it's dualistic, right? You get a reward. You give yourself a reward. But, we need to take care of our egos. Our egos are separate. They'll always be separate. So giving ourselves a reward, giving someone else a reward, it's just good. We shouldn't be attached to non-dualism. As soon as we get attached to non-dualism, then what is it? It's another cognitive distortion. So the other thing I didn't like about it in those days was that there was no empathy. You just did this, you just changed the person's behavior, and it seemed very autocratic. You got people to behave in a certain way by giving them rewards. It seemed fascist to me. But of course, we were into Everybody was fascist then. Well, of course, everybody probably still is fascist. But then, as it evolved, it began to include the work of the humanistic psychology. Well, they said, "Oh yes, well, you should do this, but in a feeling of deep caring, deep empathy for your own struggles or for your friend's struggles. Then you're not being manipulative. Then you're tapping into how they want to change, how you want to change, based on your empathy with your own struggles or with their struggles." So now I want to talk briefly about the three behavioral steps on the path: speech, action, and livelihood. Speech, action, and livelihood. So everything that I've talked about today could be, you know, this is about 6 or 7 talks so far, but I'm just giving you a snapshot. A lot of you have heard this stuff before too. So speech, right? Speech has enormous power. Think about how much of the day we talk, and think how words affect us and affect people. Remember the saying when we were kids, "Sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me." Names hurt us. Names hurt us. They hurt me when I was a kid, even though we said that. And they hurt us now. And you're never going to get your Zen so advanced that names won't hurt you. They'll hurt you. They hurt. So we want to try to speak from our heart as much as we can. And we want to speak from a place of clear seeing, not cognitive distortion, as much as we can. And then we're more wakeful, and then our speech is really extends ourselves to others. So, what I'd like you guys to do is just close your eyes for a couple of minutes and breathe. Take a couple of breaths. Focusing on your breath. And you might want to remind yourself how quickly your life is passing. Just notice how quickly your life is passing. And as you're breathing and following your breath, notice if there's someone you haven't said something to that you really need to say something. Is there something you need to say to someone that you haven't said? Just spend a minute with your heart, breathing and noticing if there's something that you really would like to say that you haven't said. And think about it for a minute. And see if you can find some words to say to them next time you're with them. Just see if any words come up to say to them. Just another minute or so. Okay, now you can gently bring your attention back to the room. I'll continue with my talk. So that's all I'm going to say about right speech. Right action, appropriate action, sound action. Gandhi said, "To come to the heart of consciousness or of truth, one must be able to love the meanest creature as oneself." So there are two sides to right action in Buddhism. Non-harming, how we speak and act with each other, learning to be grounded in non-harming. Buddha said, Refrain from that which is unskillful or that which harms. Do good and purify your heart. And the other side, cultivating caring and love for each other. Cultivating caring and love for each other in all life. So here's a story from the Tales of a Magic Monastery. He asked me what I was looking for. Frankly, I said, I'm looking for the pearl of great price. He slipped his hand into his pocket and drew it out and gave it to me. It was just like that. I was dumbfounded. Then I began to protest. You don't want to give it to me. Don't you want to keep it for yourself? But. When I kept this up, he said finally, look, is it better to have the pearl of great price or to give it away? Well, now I have it. I don't tell anyone. For some, it would just be disbelief and ridicule. You have the pearl of great price, they'd say. Others would be jealous because someone might steal it from me, or they might steal it from me. Yes, I do have it now, but there's that question that keeps coming back. Is it better to have it or to give it away? How long does that question rob me of my joy? How long does that question rob me of my joy? That's the end of the story. Tales of a Magic Monastery. I used to read from that when I gave talks in the past. So we restrain with our action our greed, our hate, and delusion as much as possible by not harming. We cultivate the opposite of greed, hatred, and delusion: love, generosity, clear seeing. And we do it moment by moment as turtle practice. Gradually understanding, a little bit of understanding seeps into the mind and the heart, just a little bit, until it becomes our way of being. Gradually, turtle practice, until it becomes our way of being. And then we don't think so much, I'm not going to harm, I won't do this, I'll take care with that. We just take care with it. We just take care with it, because it's affection. At base level, it's affection. Turtle practice. Feel connected and see that we're not separate. Take care of the planet and the creatures and the animals and even the experimental mice and rats and even the grandsons who are behaving like rats. Like it was our garden. It is our garden. Look at this garden we've got. Wow. Wow. There's some, got some stumps, you know. Got some scorpions in there. Got some rocks. It's our garden. Wow. Notice it when you go outside. Notice it. Notice it when you go home. Jack Kornfield calls right action virtuous action. Jack Kornfield says virtuous action is on one level a training. It's a training. This action is a training. We're doing Zen training. It's learning to speak, to act in our sexual life, in our business life, in our family life, to train to act more consciously, more mindfully, more compassionately, and it takes practice. It is also quite wonderfully an expression of our awakening, a foundation of our awakening, says Jack. So the last one, right livelihood. To feel good about ourselves, it's important to have some way of contributing to the world, right? Life is short. Some way of contributing. Maybe you do a job for a while, and then you change it if you haven't found work in which you can feel like you're really contributing. You need to look for it, maybe. You need to look for it. It doesn't mean it's going to be some big special job. We all want some big special job. There's a mythology in our country that we can have whatever job we want. Every kid can grow up and have every job. Well, that's becoming less and less true. Less and less true. There's no perfect job. There's no perfect job. So I thought I had a perfect job. If you think you have a perfect job, just wait for a while. I thought I had a perfect job developing programs for people with mental illness in the community. And I loved it. And I went to the legislature and got lots of support and developed lots of programs, and I loved it. But then the Republicans took over the House of Representatives. And all of a sudden, nobody would pay any attention to me. All of a sudden, I couldn't get appointments with anyone. I'd try to stop them in the halls, and they wouldn't talk with me. So my perfect job became ugh, ugh. And I kind of, I was ready to quit. Well, then I found one Republican. I'm not going to name him. Well, I should name him, but I won't. who had mental illness in his own family. And then he started listening to me, and he introduced me to other Republicans. And I thought, oh, I can do this. And it never got perfect again. And it has, actually, since I've retired, I'm told it's gotten worse. But anyway, we do it. We find a way to contribute. It's important. Life is short. So I had a friend who was a psychologist till he got burned out. He got burned out being a psychologist at a pretty young age, which can happen. You can get burned out doing anything at a pretty young age. You know that. He got burned out, and then he took a respite. He had a nephew who was having problems. And his nephew was kind of abandoned by his parents, but his nephew was an adult. His nephew was having a really hard time. Nephew lived in California, and my friend just started reaching out to him. Started, you know, calling him on the phone. They Skyped together. My friend helped him get into therapy, paid for him to get a little therapy, coached him about what to do when he's unemployed and feeling so depressed that he didn't want to go outside, and then brought him out to Minnesota to spend time with him. What I noticed in my friend was that my friend, while he was doing... The story is that the nephew now is doing really well. This is about 3 years. Turtle practice. 3 years. 3 years of TLC for my friend, and my nephew is doing really well. Really well. And my friend is doing really well. My friend is doing much better. Much better than he was a burned out psychologist or when he was left his psychology. Thought, well, what am I going to do now? His countenance has really lightened up. Really lightened up. So, it's important that we find something. We can all find something. We can all find something. And there's no template. You can find it. You can find it. And it may be part of your formal job or not part of your formal job. Okay, now I want to finish by talking about how Zen... I'll make a few points about how Zen is really nothing but behavioral therapy. I already have suggested this. I want to suggest this a little more strongly. But you can refute it, and I'll probably refute it in my next talk, if that's okay. So Suzuki, my first teacher, says, Zen is not some kind of excitement, but concentration on our usual everyday routine. So we have residential practice centers around the country. Hokkyoji and Ryomonji, Tassajara, Green Gulch, all around the country. And when we do our retreats, we're doing residential practice. Well, so what's the... If you do residential practice, you'll notice that there's very little cognitive stuff in there. That mostly it's meditation, cooking, cleaning, and supporting. Meditation, cooking, cleaning, and supporting. Meditation, cooking, cleaning, and supporting. That's about the whole deal.
Those are behaviors. And if we do those behaviors, then emotion and thought follow.
So the first guy, the first Roshi to come into this country to stay was a guy named Nyogen Senzaki. He was Paul Repp's teacher. Paul Repp's who wrote Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And Nyogen Senzaki came to the West Coast in the early 1900s. And he had a floating zendo. And he didn't think much of the Japanese priests. Most of the Japanese priests who come to this country diss the priests in Japan. He dissed them. He said, these priests that I left behind, they should become farmhands and work in the field, or else clean the parks and squares where other people are sleeping in the midnight hour. And he, Nyogen Senzaki, worked for years on the West Coast around L.A. and San Francisco as an attendant, as a houseboy, as a porter, as a cook. So very simple. So now I want to close by giving eight sort of components, I guess components. They're just manifestations of Zen behavior, behavioral therapy, since we're saying therapy for now. Eight. And these are all, this is all stuff that most of you heard before, but it's one thing to hear it, it's another thing to behave that way. That's what we're trying to do, behave that way. First, do one thing at a time. Anybody ever tell you that before? Single task, don't multitask. When walking, just walk. When eating, just eat. When sitting, just sit. Whatever you do, don't wobble. But I say, and I've been saying for years, when you wobble, just wobble. You're going to wobble sometimes. Just wobble. You're fine. You're just fine. Just wobble. If you just wobble, you'll become very steady in your wobbling. Very steady. And you won't be self-conscious, and then pretty soon you won't be wobbling anymore. I guarantee. Number two, do it slowly and deliberately. Take your time and move slowly. Turtle practice. Make your actions deliberate. Deliberate. So my last job, I had a huge list of things that I had to do, always. That was how I got through my week. Huge list. But completely, I encouraged myself to completely come back just to this task that I'm doing. Not to lean into the next one or worry about the previous one. Just to be with it. Just to be with it. Deliberately. Number three, when we do something, we try to do it completely. We just try to do it completely. We put our mind, our heart, completely into the task. We don't move on to the next task until we've finished. And if we have to put away an unfinished task, we do it with, you could say mindfulness. We're using that term so much these days that I don't like it very well. But use it, you know, you just pay attention. We try to put things away with care. Just with care. So my first teacher was sanding a lectern, kind of like this once, sanding a lectern that needed to be sanded. And he would, during work, we had a little work period, as we do here every morning, and he would be sanding, and he'd stay sanding after the work period was over. And then my friend Phil said to him, Sensei, you're doing that every morning, but you're getting some blisters on your hand. And Sensei said, well, Suzuki said, they're not bad. They're just a little tiny. And I want to finish this. I want to complete this. Very simple. And he completed it. Well, don't overdo. Don't overdo it, but complete it. If you complete it, you'll feel good. You'll feel good. It won't be hanging around anymore in your psyche, sort of haunting. Number four, do less. You 20, you 20,000, you 2016 Americans, do less. Do less. So a Zen monk, a Zen nun, a Zen practitioner isn't lazy. They wake early. But if they do less, they can do things more slowly, more completely, and with more focus and with more love. So I'm retiring. I'm retired now, supposedly. So this is what I say to myself as my list starts to get big. Tim, do less. Do less. But I try to say it from my heart rather than, do less. You SOB, right? Do less. Do less. Profanity. Self-directed profanity. Maybe some of you guys don't know about that. Some of us do. Designate, number five, designate time for certain things. If you're at a Zen residential center, even for just 2 days, if you're doing a retreat here for 5 days, there's a time for bathing, there's a time for work, there's a time for cleaning, there's a time for eating, there's a time for sitting in Zazen. Designate a time and stay with it as much as possible, because that will help you get rid of this monkey mind that's haunting you. Or it won't help you get rid of it. It'll just calm the monkey mind down. Now it's time to take my bath. I don't have to think about anything else. I'm just taking my bath. Now it's time to sit. I don't feel like sitting. No, it's time to sit. Get into a rhythm. And that rhythm, you get that into your behavior, into your body, into your psyche, into your behavior. It doesn't have to be a fancy rhythm, just a simple rhythm. And three more that I already talked about. Devote time to sitting meditation, serve others, and make your activities of daily living your meditation. As much as possible, your activities of daily living, whatever they are, whatever they are. So I'll close with my teacher's quote, there are no enlightened people, only enlightened activity. So this is what we can do together. This is what we can do together. And there is, I have about 5 minutes, or we have about 5 minutes for any questions or comments. Questions, comments. Yes, Lawrence.
Getting back to what you were saying about developing a routine, you know, ritualized kind of behavior, doesn't that tend to dull spontaneity sometimes?
We can over. So he's saying, could you guys hear him? No. Yeah. Yeah, we can over. We can get caught in our routines and become very dull. So that's the caveat. You're pointing out an important caveat. I can just I get up and I wash my face, and then I come here to Zen Center, and then next thing I do is go home and have breakfast. I can just do that on automatic, and not really be involved. And it can become a dead routine. So that's why I have to come back to my aspiration. Always my aspiration. If it's becoming a dead routine, then I'm reminding myself, why am I doing this? I'm doing this because I believe that this behavior will help me calm down and feel connected to the big world. We need to often bring the aspiration in when our routine gets kind of dead. Thank you for mentioning that, Lawrence. Yes, Benton. Ben. Thank you, Ben.
On a similar note, I've heard studies that say you only have a certain number of decisions in you every day. And having a routine saves those decisions for things that are more important.
That's pretty good. Did you hear Benton's teaching? Thank you. That's right. Having only so many things to do means that we need to keep our cognitive tool very sharp, because there's sometimes we really need to think. So if we can sort of minimize those times by keeping our cognitive tool sharp, that's good.
Anything else? Thank you.